I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm at a bend in the river, sitting on a cigarette-burnt bench, watching some swans give it the big I am. All this week, my son's woken up at 5 a.m. and shouted in the night, so to wake myself up before I recorded this, I dived into the river and had a little swim. I'm pleased to report it's now warm enough to dive in. Sure, I've probably got dysentery through my ear holes, and my leg will probably be broken by a swan next time, but the rush is worth it. My guest this week is the comedian, actor and screenwriter Tiffany Stevenson. I loved her in Game Face, playing the greatest of all villains, your ex's new girlfriend. Talking of villains, Tiffany's spoken quite a bit in her stand-up about being a stepmother. In fact, she's going on tour with her new show Mother in July, as in next month. And in the show, she's so funny about the archetype of the evil, witchy stepmother and what fun it is to rub up against that in your love life. We also talked about her career, working with other women, what it's like to be in a long-term relationship, her panic years, and how she became a stepmother. Please do stick around after my chat with Tiffany, because I'll be talking to psychologist and the founder of Happy Steps, Lisa Dudson, all about stepfamilies, being a stepmother, and what it's like to fall in love with someone who has children. In the meantime, sit up, brush your hair, crack your knuckles, and enjoy my chat with the hilarious Tiffany Stevenson. How are you, and how is your body? What's going on down there?
Did you say what's going on down there?
Only because you're sitting down, so I can only see your shoulders.
Oh, right. Okay.
We can keep it shoulders and head only.
I did have a smear test recently, so thanks for asking. Still got it, in case you're wondering. Still got it. By that, I mean still got a lovely vagina, not HPV, which is great. Also, can we... just as a general request, I think we should stop calling it speculum, because that sounds like something that's traded on the stock market.
You got to speculum to accumulum.
Yeah, exactly. Scrape, scrape, sell, sell. So I'm good. I've had a smear test. That's all up to date. That's fine. Otherwise, my body has been battered around a bit. I had a car crash about a month ago, 5 weeks ago. So I'm currently have a scar on my lip, which, look, I'm quite a vain person, but you know, I am my age that I am now. So I'm letting go of that a little bit and going, that's okay. If I can have a cool lip scar, I don't mind. But at the moment, it kind of looks shiny and like a cold sore. And that was the result of an airbag going off. I just got sort of beaten up by an airbag, basically, is what happened.
Are you getting bad sleep, and is it sort of psychologically done anything?
Or
you?
It has a little bit, actually. I didn't think it would, and then the kind of shock of it sort of comes back every now and again. I was very gun-shy getting into cars for a little bit, and, but I've seemed
to be... I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. You know, it could have been so much worse, so that's my main thing.
I think having a little scar can be quite gnarly. My mum, I'm sure she won't mind me telling you, had a much-regretted snake tattoo up her thigh. They were like, we can laser this off, and it will cost you, like, thousands of pounds, or we can just slice it out, and you'll have a little scar. And she was like, I'm quite up for the scar. So she's got quite a cool scar on her leg.
Wow. I would be a baby and
you'd get the lasering.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm impatient enough to be like, oh, yeah, just do it with a spoon. There are so many reasons I wanted to talk to you. I mean, mainly because you're one of the funniest women I've ever seen. You won't remember this. It was so long ago. But you did Josie Long's Night, Lost Treasures of Black Heart, and you talked about Christine McVie.
I did. Oh, my God.
It was so lovely. I remember just having this, like, one... she's brilliant. Like, I was like, yes, I'm absolutely on board with this. And then there was like a man talking, like it was not even like a heckle, but a bit of a heckle. And you just said to him,
oh yeah, like a sexually confident woman in her 30s. It's quite frightening up close, isn't it? And I was like, oh my God, she's amazing. She's so amazing. It was a very good put down.
I'm glad someone was there to like commemorate that night, because I don't think I ever did that bit again. I'm sure I should dig it out. I've got it somewhere, but I think it was about feminism and the friendship between the two of them. Yeah. I seem to remember it being about how Christine McVie, when Stevie Nicks joined the band, because I'm obsessed with Stevie Nicks, mm-hmm. how she could have been threatened by this woman who was,
yes,
I think maybe 10 years younger than her, who was instantly sort of put into the role as like front person of the band almost. And actually the two of them decided that there was power in two women. Suddenly there was a female voice in the band,
yeah,
for the first time. And actually, why don't we be a team? And I just thought that was a really beautiful sort of example, sort of late 70s, wasn't it, when they joined?
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, I'd love to do a show about these kind of women in music and how groundbreaking and stuff they were. I'm sure someone already does that, but you know.
I think you should. I would watch yours. Talking about comedy, I wanted to ask you, because the sort of almost the conceit of this podcast is that at 28, I remember looking around, everyone around me was either getting married or having babies or buying houses or getting promotions or doing sort of major landmark things. And I'd been made redundant. I was single. I was like, had to move back in with my mum. And I remember thinking, what the hell is going on here? Like, this feels like more of an adjustment than my adolescence. And we have no name for it. I don't know what the hell's going on. And then I heard you on a podcast say that at 28, you went to Edinburgh for the first time. And I, yes, thought, oh, so she had, like, so basically tell me, what were you doing when I was freaking out? What were you doing at 28?
So at 28, yes, that's right. I feel like 2005. Yes, so it would have been August, maybe 2006, before my 28th birthday. We're all getting my age now.
Oh, yeah. As an actor, you're not.
Oh, no. Look, listen, I say my age. My age is everywhere and I don't care. Although I will say it's frustrating to note how much less there is when you enter your 40s.
Mm.
Everyone says it and you're like, oh, and then you really see it. Like,
yeah,
across the board. And I'm like, oh, God, can I bang a drum about something else? You know, like now it's ageism. But also we're in an industry constantly where, especially with stand-up, that there's this kind of, a lot of us can get over the years an internalized misogyny because the industry tells, yes, us that there's only room for one of us at a time. And therefore it's hard not to feel in competition constantly with other women and, you know, and even, or just to feel like, yeah, like, and what would be joyous is to be able to do all the shows that I've done or do with those young women who are coming through rather than be told,
we've already got a woman.
Yeah, we need to get new women through. Like we're getting new, because none of the men get moved on. None of the men who are my age get less work for being my age. They get more. They keep going, you know. Whereas I feel for us, it's a bit like, well, you're not the hot new young thing anymore. And you go, no, I'm just someone who's built an entire career and I'm really good. How about that? But yes, so I'd been sort of messing about doing a bit of stand-up comedy. I was working with a street theatre company, in fact, and it was an all-female company. It was really great. And it was really inspiring in terms of like a couple of the girls who were there, Kathy and Heather, Kathy owned the company, were doing stand-up. So I saw them doing it and I was like, oh, maybe I want to do that, you know, because I'd been acting for years and I was always going up for this same kind of blonde bimbo, big boob parts.
Right.
And I was like, well, how about, what if I can like take ownership of that narrative and be a bit more playful with it, because the circuit just was not welcoming of women. If you've been to Josie's gigs, you know that she created her own space where everyone felt like they could get paid and that it wouldn't be this awful misogynist atmosphere. So at 28, I went to Edinburgh for the first time and that was a whole new world for me.
Have you read Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo? Because she was similar. She was like in an all-female theatre company in her 20s. And then like she didn't start writing until a bit later, like writing fiction and stuff. So I think there must be, I've never been in one, but I imagine there is something specifically really enlivening and supportive about being in an all-female theatre group. Because it's basically saying you are part of a, like, there's camaraderie, but there's also a healthy sense of competition. You are doing something creative that doesn't blot out other possibilities of creative work. What a good starting place.
Really great. And I will take a comparison to Bernardine Evaristo. But yes, it was. Swank is the name of the company.
And
it was
just, God. Yeah.
Do you know Swank?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Right. So that's who I was working with for years and years. And Kathy opened up like a whole world of stuff to me. So yeah, I got to do Glastonbury for the first time.
Were you at that point already in a long-term relationship?
When I was in Swank, yeah. So I've been with we met, I just found some of my old stand-up, speaking of the panic years, the other day, where I say that my boyfriend, I met him just before I was 30, so he got me just before, like it's something gross that like he got me just before I turned, just before I spoiled. I met him. So yes, I did my first Edinburgh at 28. I met him at 29.
Wow.
That was, yeah.
Why, what was happened? Like what had led up to that you then, because those two things to me speak of a healthy sense of self-worth and risk-taking and understanding of yourself. How did you get to that to be at 28, 29?
I've been to a couple of comedy nights and stuff, and I think I met Phil Nichol and he was doing this play with Stuart Lee. And so I got cast in talk radio. So that happened in 2008. So I was single then. I say single, I was kind of like seeing guys, but also this is me entering the world of stand-up comedy. When I think about it now, like you ask, how is your body? I have over the years, I mean, probably more so in my mid-30s, but put on a shit ton of weight as a layer of protection. And I know people probably talk about this, but looking back, I was like, one of the great things about being with my, you know, now fiance is that there was a year, maybe a year and a half, where I'd gone into the world of stand-up comedy. And if I thought that acting had like kind of sleazy people, it really was. It's like a lamb to the slaughter. You know, I was, yeah, like 28, 29, tiny, gaslit by like some awful male comedians who, you know, I remember showing a clip to someone of me at the Comedy Store and them going, wow, the camera really does add 10 pounds.
Oh,
and when I think about it now, I was like, I was like a size 8. Like I was tiny. I was so tiny. So I sort of didn't know how sort of toxic that world would be when I first went into it. And listen, it's improved loads. And there's a weird thing that happens that you sort of get grudging respect off of some of these people and stuff. But I just think, I sort of think I had no idea sort of going into that, how, you know, comedy has a lot of damaged people in it, you know, and people are trying to deal with their stuff. And I just didn't know. And then I met Paul, and I think that was like, he was exactly the right person for me. In that my dad said to me, my dad had come to the Edinburgh Fringe, I think maybe in 2006, to see me in the play, to come up for a week. And he was like, you just need to be with someone who isn't threatened by your, isn't threatened by your shine, like you shining. And it's such a weird, because it's exactly who Paul is. He's this really,
he was in Aswad.
Shine like a light. But the weird thing is, saying my dad said this is like, it's not like my dad is the one who like doles out pieces of life advice. One of the few times that my dad's ever sort of spoken to me about relationships or anything like that. But he said, you need someone who's not threatened by how brightly you shine. And then, you know, I met Paul, and this was someone who was my champion, who supported me, but didn't want to compete with me for what I was doing, but was also creative and brilliantly artistic himself. And, you know, so I had all of that. But yeah, it was, I don't know if that answered the question.
It does. It completely does. It also leads me into the next question, which I ask with trepidation because I used to hate it. But I also am interested to hear your answer, which is, if you get together with someone at 29, 30, especially if you're straight and cisgendered, people very quickly start talking about you getting married and having a baby.
Sure.
And you have only recently got engaged, right?
I talked about this a lot in stand-up shows. At some point in your 30s, every time you have dinner with your family, it's like dining with the Ceausescus. In that they're like, why is she not pregnant? Is she going to have baby? What is, burn her, she's a witch. Are you on pill? You know, like, so, but recently I was saying, it's bizarre with which the impunity people, you know, think that they can ask you about that. And then they point at your womb like it's a car up on bricks. Like, are you going to use that? Like, because that's gonna have to go down to the scrap heap if you don't. Like, what are you doing with it?
So true. It's so true. There's people are really uncomfortable with you being either private or ambivalent about what you do with your womb in a way that they're not about anything else. It's like, I don't know, like no one's ever asked me what I'm doing with my liver or bumhole or even like even my ears. Like, you seem to be wearing a lot of headphones, Nelly. Are you sure? Like,
well, I try to describe it to men as kind of going, imagine someone constantly pointing at your dick and going, you're jizzing with that. What are you doing with that jizz? Are you wasting that jizz?
How did you weather those constant pointing at your up on bricks womb?
I sort of weathered it by going, I'm working, I'm having this career, I'm doing this thing. And plus, I have a stepson. So, you know.
This is a big bugbear of mine, that if you are child free, you seem to have to hold up something else that you're doing as a sort of almost sort of proof of worth and purpose to people. If you know, that in that time where people are asking if you're going to get married and have a baby. So when you were holding up your career, did you feel a pressure to kind of prove yourself with that? Or like, would you have been able to say, I'm just not having a baby, and that's just, I'm not doing it?
Yes, I suppose in a way you do feel like you have to sort of justify not making those same life choices as everyone else and them not being celebrated. And I don't think I ever really heard it sort of talked about, you know. I remember there being an episode of Sex and the City actually where she turns up at a baby shower and she brings,
oh yes,
a gift, and she takes her shoes off and the shoes go missing, and it's like, I give all these gifts, I do all these things, and like, you're judging me for having these shoes, and those are the things that I do for myself and stuff. So that was maybe the first time that I'd seen someone having to force a justification for having something nice and expensive.
Yeah.
When a friend of theirs had a kid and couldn't afford to do that. So
someone said to me at a barbecue once, do you have a baby? Or maybe she said, rather, and I said no. She said, oh, so you're a career girl. And I remember thinking, I could be neither. Like, I could be neither of those things. I could be not driven, I could be not motivated by children and not driven by my career, and I still would be welcome at this barbecue.
Yes.
Actually.
I think a lot of people project their own thoughts and fears and feelings about their state of parenthood or not parenthood, or, you know, and I know it can become all-consuming for people, and you know, if people are trying and they haven't been able to, that becomes such a huge part of their lives. And I think as well, I've had a bit of a sort of open thing of the last few years. If I get pregnant, I get pregnant. If I don't, I don't. We'll just sort of see what happens. But I didn't want to be actively trying because I didn't want it to seem like it could be another potential thing that I could fail at.
Yeah.
Which, and the language around that is so bad.
Like losing things, failing, all of that stuff. It's a horrible. I remember a friend of mine told her mum that they were going to start trying, and that like completely exploded my brain in so many directions. So I was like, one, you're telling your mum, like, me and my partner are going to now start shagging a lot more, which is weird. And also, you're like then welcoming in all your mum's hope and expectation that might then get frustrated or disappointed. How can you bear that? And also, what if you change your mind? Then you're going to have to, like, there's just so many reasons that I wasn't comfortable telling anyone. It felt like that was too, I couldn't carry the weight of their expectation as well as my own.
Right. Yeah.
Too much.
It's, and also I had like a chemical, what they call a chemical pregnancy a couple of times, which a lot of my friends didn't seem to know what that was. And I was like, oh, it just means that the egg has been fertilized, but it doesn't attach. So it's very, very, it's like the earliest version of a miscarriage, I suppose. But again, that's a weird thing to talk about because it's a weird thing of like, and doing that has made me realize that there's probably been a few times in my life that that's happened to me and I've not realized at the time.
My friend Rebecca said exactly the same, and that we didn't even have a language. She called it, the egg hadn't plugged into the matrix. I mean, like, we must know, like, there must be better language for this.
Yes.
All of those slightly earlier or slightly heavier periods, maybe that had happened before and you didn't.
Yes, that realize. you didn't know that's what it was. There's points where I was like, I'm not ready for kids. I think I'm too selfish and all of that. And then there was a point of, I think it was okay societally to kind of say, I don't want kids, or I don't like them, or I'm not ready for them. But then I also think there has definitely been a thought process for me of thinking, I can't have both. And then I see women who've got huge careers who are doing, you know, really well, you know, someone like my friend Catherine Ryan, you know, whose career flourished when she almost like had her daughter. And so I know that that obviously does happen, but it's kind of hard to balance it all. But I think some honest conversations that, you know, there are people who definitely don't want their whole life and have made a conscious decision to do that. There are people who are like, I don't think I do, and then maybe do, and then get to the point of going, or even a point of going, is that going to happen for me now as well? That's a moment that I think women visit of kind of going, oh, that's gone. And I never actively pursued it, but now I know I can't. Now I know it's a thing that I can't have. So I think those are all very much, they're very... not thorny, but like personal and difficult. And yeah, I feel like more conversation that can be had around them, the better, really.
I completely agree. Do you know something I'm embarrassed to admit to you? Which is, I've written this whole book about the panic years, and I've done quite a lot of these interviews, and I haven't spoken to anyone specifically about being a stepmother. And I feel like that was a massive blind spot for me, even though like I'm from a complicated family where we have several stepmothers. I didn't think about it. It's so weird. I don't know why it didn't occur to me as something that I should be interrogating.
I think it's tricky and it's sensitive. And for me, even my last show, so the show that I'm going to be touring like in the summer, I have a few dates. I hadn't spoken about it in my stand-up, really. I'd maybe had the odd joke or two about, but it was more about me and Paul and how I had one joke, and this was probably about 7 years ago, about not wanting to argue in front of him, because I don't, like, my parents would argue in front of me as a kid. So I had a thing of going, I think I'm becoming middle class, because I would move the argument into the kitchen and turn on the bean grinder to mask to mask the sound of us swearing in the kitchen, so that he didn't hear like his dad and his stepmom sort of going at each other. So I resisted for a long time. I think it's because I didn't want it to affect him. Whereas now he's, you know, a teenage boy, and he's very funny and he's smart. And he, you know, he's, since he's a kid, he's sort of seen my stand up as well. He's seen me at Glastonbury and stuff. So I just felt I had a bit more, I felt ready to talk about it. But it's thorny. And obviously the depictions, and again, I talk about this in the show, but the depictions of, I go, oh, I think historically we've had quite a good run. The evil queen from Snow White, Janine Butcher in EastEnders, and like Lady Tremaine. So I really wanted to talk about the sort of positive experiences of what stepmotherhood can give you. And what, again, our obsession societally with, you know, in the, I had a lot of people come up after that show and be like in tears, like stepmothers, like kind of going, this is the first time I've heard our experience spoken about, adoptive parents, you know, just, and, you know, biological mothers as well, you know, like I talked about mothering in a broad sense, and how we can, you know, we have these different figures in our lives who provide that for us, and what you can get from it. And also at the end, I talked a little bit about being the age that I am now, and I don't know if I'll have, not my own, but like...
biological.
Yeah, I don't know if that's in the sort of thing for me. And, but also I feel like also part of my career as well, then there's this conflict, which is in this panic years, is that a lot of the time I've felt I've put my happiness on hold for this career and what I want in my life. And that has been a constant thing of trying to go, I'm trying to have this career, and I'm trying to be a stand-up, and I'm trying to create it all myself, and I'm trying to have autonomy. And then at the same time, I'm like, oh, does that mean then I've just breezed through, like I've gone from like definitely not wanting kids to thinking maybe I do want them now. And also there are messages in media that kind of make women think that, well, just don't worry about it. You can do it in your mid 40s. And that's not true for the huge, huge majority of people.
And I think that I would say this, but I think that is almost a symptom of having a privatized fertility treatment. If we have like privatized fertility treatment, which most people, you get only a certain amount of IVF on the NHS, and only then if you're in a straight relationship, and only then if you're lucky.
I mean, I only recently found out that, for example, that stepmothers are denied, depending on the area. Like, I wouldn't be allowed IVF on the NHS because I have a stepson and my partner has a child.
So then you're in the hands of, like, basically a kind of cowboy, like Wild West, of people who will financially benefit from you, like, making decisions that might make it harder for you to get biologically pregnant if at some point you choose to. And it makes me so angry and upset, because while I, like, completely and utterly in my body and brain and everything see not having a baby as valid and good, I also think that we have to be realistic, which say that people might change their mind. I don't want to say to people, well, you say that now, but, you know, give it 10 years, you might want a baby.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying it could happen that you change your mind, and to be told that you can put it off forever might make that harder than if you'd been told, oh yeah, like that's got a time limit on. That's a deadline, in the same way that one day your body is going to change and your brain is going to change and one day you're going to die.
I think Jackie Cation has a great line about it in her stand-up, and I might mash it, but she says something like, in her 50s, she was like, and now I just feel like I'm happy, I'm married, I really love my life, and I feel like I could, like, have a kid now. Why can't I have a kid now? And she's like, because science, you know, like, is the sort of thing. So I feel like, and then I feel like there's a lot of frustration there, because I feel like we're in a world, especially with women who do stand up and entertainment, we're in this sort of like world of arrested development. And I watch male peers and male colleagues buy houses off of being professionally funny and doing all of that. And I'm still, you know, it's hard to watch a guy on his sixth chance, because he's been a dick, like, relentlessly going, oh, can I just have my one? Could I have my one chance, please? And kind of then, and that's what I mean of postponing my happiness, of going, well, if I can just get my TV series away, if I can just get that, then I know that if I drop out for a year, that I can come back and I have a career to come back to. And I know so many women have this with maternity leave. So it feels like it's a choice that you have to actively make. Do I want to have this career, or do I want to be a mother?
What's it like being a stepmother, please, Tiffany Stevenson? I've not done it.
It is, it's wonderful. The best bits about it are you get to be a part of this child's life and help shape an awesome human being. And you can be a friend and a confidant, sometimes in a way that a parent can't, or you can be funny and silly and sometimes the way a parent has to be. Our parents are our parents, so we sort of try to be a bit more serious with them, or take them, you know, that's their role, whereas you can have a slightly different role to that. And so I'm very grateful that I have him in my life, and he's an awesome, awesome boy. He's growing into a man, and, you know, I have the same sort of, I feel like I have the same hopes for him and fears for him as, you know, any parent does. He doesn't call me mum. He calls me Tiff. That's what he's always called me. I'm just his Tiff.
It is your name.
It is my name. And I think I say, you know, I never really used the term stepmom until a couple of years ago in the summer in the garden. I'd gone, stepmom needs a margarita. It is a bit like I'm teaching him how to make cocktails and stuff, because I think all kids should have one cocktail in their repertoire.
It's a vocation. You know, everyone needs a bit of vocational training before they're let loose. Yeah. I agree.
So, you know, we bond over stuff like comedy and film and watching stuff. And he's just very, very funny. He's got a real comedic sort of knack, and so that doesn't mean it's easy. I think it's stepmom is in a very hard position, because there's no Hallmark card. Like, you don't get any of the, I think, don't expect it, because you're not going to get it. You don't get any of the praise when he does things well and right.
Of course you don't. Yeah, I've just thought about it. You don't get it. At parents' evening, everyone says, well done, Tiffany.
No, oh my God. You don't sort of have that. It's, you know, then that goes with with bio parents, I think. So you have to just be secure in your own knowledge that you're helping and being a good parent and doing all of that. And then sometimes as well, you know, it's just a difficult, because there is, you know, ultimately there's another woman in your life who has a lot of say about how your life runs. And if you don't know that woman and you weren't friends beforehand or anything like that, you know, inevitably, you know, you just try and get through it the best you can. And so it hasn't been without its difficulties, but I think we're all, you know, I think the proof is in the pudding, as in there's a really great kid there who's, you know, who's super. But yes, it's not a role that anyone ever applies for. If you imagine it as like a job, someone's like, do you want to go up for the role of stepmother? No, thanks.
Yes. No one puts on their Tinder profile, I'm really looking to become a stepmother. That's what I'm in for.
And I think that's, you know, it would be useful to have that as part of the conversation.
God, yeah.
To kind of change that, to have people go, actually, this is a way of me kind of having kit, but I've not had the full on commitment, you know, or I've not... You know, some women are like, I don't want to put my body through that. And some women are like, I don't want the full-time commitment of that. And so it allows you to have that role. So I think if we could reframe it in a positive, there's so many blended families now. And, you know, it's a huge deal, really, because like in the White House now, there's two stepmothers. There's Jill Biden and there's Kamala Harris. So, you know, I felt like that was a huge moment for the visibility of stepmothers, you know, and... But I feel if the conversation around that could change, I feel that would be
lovely. Hello, welcome back. I'm still here on my bench, hoping no teenagers come over and ask me to roll them a cigarette. Thank you so much to Tiffany for talking to me. I mean, you can't tell because this is audio, but during our conversation, she was sitting in front of such a nice bookshelf and wearing a really good yellow jumper. But hey, let's not get hung up on details. As I mentioned, Tiffany is a great stand-up and you should take the opportunity to see her if you have the chance. Luckily, she's hit the ground running as soon as lockdown lifted and is performing all over the UK in July. You can get details on her website, tiffstevenson.co.uk. Now, as someone who has between 1 and 6 siblings, depending on how you want to count it, I obviously have some skin in the step family game. So I wanted to speak to an expert about the unique challenges and characteristics of step families. Lisa Dudson is a psychologist and the founder of Happy Steps, the UK's only research-based step family resource centre. Apparently, step families are now the fastest growing family type in the UK, and it's estimated that 1 in 3 of all families are now step or blended families. For people who don't have step parents or haven't been raised in a step family, what are we talking about? How does one become a step parent? How does that come about? And what does it look like once you're in it?
Can happen that, you know, a relationship's broken down. It doesn't have to be anyone's fault. You know, relationships break down and it's really sad. And you find yourself, you know, repartnering and either you've got children or they've got children or you both have children and you may then go on to have other children. So you can find yourself in a really complex family. And it's just saying, how do we deal with this complexity? You know, families are complex, and I like to think of step families as just having another layer of complexity. And I always say to people, you know, the biggest issue will be, you know, all about my role in this family and how we do discipline with me being the step parent. But then in a year, 2 years, 5 years time, you look back and go, oh, our issues now are about, you know, the teens and terrible teens. It's nothing to do with being a step family. It's just we're a family. You know, that's what happens. It becomes less of a step issue, but just more of a parenting issue. And I think then you know that, you know, you can tick that box and say, yes, we've done that bit now. We're sort of integrated and we'll muddle along like any other family. There is no perfect family.
In this country, do we have a sort of legal definition for step-parent? Like, who constitutes a step-parent and who is... just a partner?
We don't have a particular absolute definition. It's really left up to individuals to whether they think they align themselves with being a step parent. So imagine if you met somebody and just sort of, you know, just got to know them, you clearly wouldn't think, oh, I'm their children's step parent now. But as you progress through a relationship, there comes a point when you feel that you are in a, you know, in a position where you feel that things have moved on somewhat. But everybody is different. So it might be that you feel that's when you maybe move in together, or, you know, when you start building a relationship with their children. Some people never feel that they are at that point, you know, it's I'm still the partner, and it could be because the children are a lot older, in which case you may never feel like you're a step parent. So no, there is no legal definition, but it's much more about what feels right for you and your family.
My family has within it, I mean, so many iterations of step parent and partner that I sort of looked at and thought, actually, you know, according to your maths and where you're drawing the line, I could almost have sort of four step parents or just my own. Does that mean then that there is sometimes that grey area? Is that in itself a kind of cause of some difficulty or tension?
One of the key areas when I work with clients, it's about identifying your role in the family. And it may be that you disagree with your partner. So, for example, your partner might think, well, you're taking on the role of stepmom, you're looking after the children, doing everything for them that their mum would do. And you might be thinking, hang on, I'm not ready for that. I'm happy to just sort of be their friend, you know? And that can be a cause of tension, because if you don't agree with your partner, obviously you're going to keep effectively letting each other down, because, you know, you're not doing what they expect. So it's around defining what that role is, and it can change, and it should change over time. Mm-hmm. But it's about having realistic expectations as well.
What kind of information are people looking for? How to lock their door?
How did this happen? So they're sort of looking initially, I mean, there's a range, I suppose. A lot of people are looking for education. So they find themselves at the beginning of a relationship, usually in the first 2 years, and they just want more understanding. So why do I feel like I feel? How do we resolve the sort of the conflict issues? How do we deal with the ex-partners who are telling us what to do? You know, all of these sort of regular questions. There are ways they can get that information online, or I, before COVID, used to run workshops. So we could sort of, you know, all sit for a day and talk about the issues. And really, it's about arming them with information so they feel more confident and, you know, prepared, if you like. But sometimes they come for specific reasons. You know, they might find that they don't like the way they feel about their stepchild. They can't bond with their stepchild, you know, how they feel guilty because, you know, they're not seeing their own children as much, and how do they... So there's very specific things. So they might come for, you know, for one-off questions. I see it as a really positive thing, because it means that you've accepted that there's an issue and you're coming to fix that problem. And often you'll find some solutions and you move on. And, you know, I think that's, you know, it's very rewarding, you know, because I feel that I'm helping people in, even if it's in a small way.
I learned from your website that step families are the fastest growing family type in the UK.
Oh, I mean, that's been the case for a long time. It's interesting, actually. It's very hard to get proper statistics. So obviously, you'd normally go to the Office for National Statistics. But step families are really difficult to measure. You know, even in the recent census, you can only count children if they live with you for the majority of time. So you could have a partner and consider yourselves to be in a step relationship, but if the kids don't live with you the majority of the time, you're not counted on the census, so you don't even exist as a step family. So we undercount step families massively. A lot of those statistics are sort of, they're gleaned from researchers. It's sort of very accepted that they are the fastest growing, but as I've said, it's very difficult to quantify exactly how many there are.
As dynamics change and people move out and people move in, like, the definition of who's being a step parent is going to change.
Exactly.
As well through the course of a relationship.
Yeah. And if you can't count them, because you don't know if you're saying, well, it's when you're married, that's one thing, or is it when you live together? You know, it's very difficult, you know. How do you measure it?
Who's buying the milk? I'd say that's what we have to go by.
There you go. Maybe that's what we should use.
You've written a book called How to Be a Happy Stepmom.
I have.
So give me the answer. How can you go about being happy in your role?
So there's a good question. So I think one of the first things is to recognise it takes time. So it takes years to be fully enmeshed and, you know, and a sort of functioning step family. It doesn't take months. It really takes years. Probably about 4 years is normal. So, you know, make sure you give each other time and be kind to each other. You know, don't expect your partner. You have to have realistic expectations. They're not suddenly going to love your children and vice versa. It's about giving each other time, learning to get on with the children, learning about them, you know, getting to know them as people. And they've got to get to know you. Accept, you've got to be polite to each other. You've got to respect each other, but you don't have to love each other at the beginning at all. That you know, let that come over time. And just, you know, keep talking to your partner. I think being able to talk openly is really important. And we say that it, like it's easy. And if it was easy, we'd all do it.
It's, good point.
It is really difficult because it's sort of saying, oh, I'm struggling to get on with your children, or I, you know, all of those things. And we don't want to do that. People want to be kind and they want to, you know, things to come easily. And I would say if you are struggling, reach out to somebody, you know, go and read a book. It doesn't have to be mine. It can be, you know, it can be another one. There's lots of good books out there. Or go and talk to a friend that perhaps is in a step relationship. But, you know, don't hold it in. You know, do try. And, you know, it's a bit like that old saying of, you know, eat an elephant slowly a bit at a time. Don't try and fix everything. Work out what's really annoying you, irritating you. Talk to your partner and see if you can fix something. You know, it can be really simple. It's always the little things that cause the issues. You know, it's always the little things that, you know, just break us. And then we go, no, I can't, you know, I can't do this anymore.
Isn't it just, I mean, it's so true. It's about things like what time bedtime is, how much is a reasonable amount of, you know, fruit to eat in a day? Where do you put your trainers? It's those things that cause much more discord, I think, than the sort of big principles of parenting. You know, it always comes down to sort of washing up and the TV.
Absolutely. And I think in a step family, when you've got, you know, a step parent sort of saying, you know, oh, you always let your child stay up later or not do this. And it's this issue of discipline. So it's cracking that. It goes back to the sort of work out what your role is. And if your role is to be involved because you're at that stage in your relationship, then you have to sort of work out what are the big things that we really want to focus on. It might be, you know, meal times or whatever. And what are the consequences? So we're both doing the same thing. You know, you're not going to be too much of a disciplinarian, you know, or am I allowed to tell your child off? Or are you going to be cross with me if I do that? And it's being on the same page so that the children don't divide and conquer, which children always do with parents. They will always find the weakness, you know.
Hello, 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 and hello. Thank you so much for coming back. Thank you truly to Tiffany Stevenson and Lisa Dudson for giving up their time to talk to me. And thank you to my lovely producer, Rich Jarman, for, as ever, doing a brilliant job. Next week's guest is the writer, children's novelist, broadcaster, and zombie mum, Laura Dockrill. I've just finished Laura's amazing book, What Have I Done? And cannot wait for you all to hear our chat, so please come back next Friday for that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review. Write what you like, but just make it nice. It makes a huge difference, feels great, and like riding a swan like it's a very small white horse will cost you absolutely nothing.
This is a brand new audio production.